You're listening to an event from the U.S. Institute of Peace, part of the USIP podcast network. For more information about our work around the world, visit usip.org and check us out on social media.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is George Moose, and as the acting president of the United States Institute of Peace, it's my great pleasure to welcome you all to this very special symposium on peace through agriculture. And I want also to welcome those who are joining us this afternoon online. I am especially delighted to be sharing the stage with our keynote speaker, Ambassador Ken Quinn, who is President Emeritus of the World Food Prize Foundation. And I wanted to begin by extending a special welcome to Heidi Kuhn, the winner of the 2023 World Food Prize, otherwise and affectionately known as the Nobel Prize for Agriculture. I know that there were several members of Congress who had hoped to be with us this afternoon, but it turns out that this is very much a business day on the Hill, and indeed very important business being transacted because its decisions are being made about who is going to occupy chairmanships and other key leadership positions. But I know that they will be interested in our deliberations this afternoon. So for those of you who may be coming to USIP for the first time, the Institute was established by an act of Congress in 1984 with the purpose of helping to mitigate, resolve, and prevent violent conflicts around the world, and indeed to build peace in their aftermath. As we mark the 40th anniversary of the Institute, I would submit that the case for the conflict prevention and peace-building agenda has never been more urgent or more compelling. It's fitting, I think, that we come to this event today fresh from our observance of America's most celebrated holiday, Thanksgiving. And indeed, on Thanksgiving Day, as I was sitting at my home computer, thinking about the words I might use to welcome you to today's event, as someone who majored in American studies at a small liberal arts college nestled in the cornfields of Iowa, I was reminded that the theme for our symposium today, Peace Through Agriculture, is one that is deeply rooted in American history. It was indeed the belief by the nation's founders that our democracy should be grounded in a citizenry made up of educated farmers. In the words of Thomas Jefferson, cultivators of the earth are the most valuable citizens. They are the most vigorous, the most independent, the most virtuous, and they are tied to their country and wedded to its liberty and interests by the most lasting bands. And this from the letter that Jefferson wrote to George Washington on August the 14th, 1787. Agriculture is our wisest pursuit because it will in the end contribute most to real wealth, good morals, and happiness. And he might well have added, to peace. There's no doubt that Washington himself, a citizen farmer, would have endorsed, embraced that vision. And I think there's good reason to believe that Jefferson, in turn, would have endorsed and embraced one of Washington's most cherished visions, that of a national institution dedicated to teaching the lessons of how to make peace and to maintain peace both at home and abroad. And indeed, Washington's vision was the inspiration for this very institution, the United States Institute of Peace. And the edifice in which we gather today, this stately edifice, monument, tribute to peace, stands on the very piece of land that Washington had imagined, had proposed for his National Peace Academy. Over the course of our history, agriculture has been the source of the bounty that has nurtured and sustained our nation, and the bedrock upon which American democracy and American prosperity have been built. And moreover, the American people have been generous in sharing that bounty with people all around the world, those who have been less fortunate than we. That spirit found its embodiment in Public Law 480, which we now all affectionately know as the Food for Peace Act. This year indeed marks the 70th anniversary of the passage of the Food for Peace Act, which was adopted in 1954 with overwhelming bipartisan support. Authored by Senator Hubert Humphrey and signed into law by President Eisenhower, it was later given the title Food for Peace by President Kennedy. And in giving it that title in 1961, Kennedy said, "Food is strength, food is peace, and food is freedom. And food is a helping hand to people around the world whose goodwill and friendship we want." Over the past 70 years, that vision has expanded to include assistance and support to help countries develop their own agricultural capacities. Sadly, we are today confronted with the reality that too many countries have neither food nor peace. And we have come to understand the dynamics that connect and reinforce these two life-threatening deficits. In our conversations today, we will explore the connection between agriculture and peace, and between food insecurity and conflict. We are fortunate to have with us today some of the world's most highly regarded experts representing some of the world's most reputable organizations and institutions. They will begin by leading us in an examination of how armed conflict has been shown to be both a driver of global hunger and a consequence of food insecurity. How, for example, intercommunal conflicts and gang violence are directly linked to food insecurity. How, on a much larger scale, conflicts in places like Ukraine can disrupt local and global food supply chains and threaten the welfare of thousands of people all around the world. And how, in every region of the world, long-term weather trends are being exacerbated by extreme weather shocks, leading to disruptions in agricultural production and increased conflict over both land and scarce food resources. But we also know that the development of agriculture has proven to be one of the most powerful tools in building resilience, prosperity, and peace in vulnerable communities around the world. Our second panel this afternoon will examine how assistance and technical support to local farmers in conflict-affected areas can enable them to produce enough to sustain themselves and their communities, and how this in turn can contribute to conditions that nurture peace and stability. I believe, and I think it has been demonstrated, that the United States is uniquely positioned to leverage our knowledge of agriculture and agricultural technologies to help local farmers use production techniques, allowing them to become more resilient and food secure, and therefore enabling their communities and their countries to become more stable, productive, and peaceful. Today, we are proud to partner with Roots of Peace, a nonprofit humanitarian organization that has helped people in conflict-affected countries and communities around the world by removing landmines from fields and replacing them with sustainable agricultural crops. During our fireside chat later in the program, we will have a chance to hear World Food Prize laureate Heidi Kuhn talk about the work of her organization, what it is doing in places such as Afghanistan, Vietnam, Guatemala, and Angola to help local communities recover from conflict and build peace through sustainable agriculture. But for now, I can think of no better person to lead off today's conversation than my friend and colleague of more than 50 years, Ambassador Kenneth Quinn. Ken has had an extraordinary career, 32-year career in government. And during that time, he held a number of senior positions, including at the National Security Council, the U.S. mission to the United Nations in Vienna, and as ambassador to Cambodia. After leaving government service, Ken joined the World Food Prize Foundation and served there for 20 years as its president. Inspired by the work and the vision of its founder, Dr. Norman Borlaug, the foundation leads an important work of a global community of scholars and researchers, policymakers, and agricultural practitioners who share the goal of addressing and ending food insecurity through advancements in agriculture. And through the annual granting of the World Food Prize, the foundation also recognizes and honors outstanding individuals such as Heidi Kuhn, who are making significant and measurable contributions to improving the world's food supply. Ken, it's a pleasure for me to welcome you to the U.S. Institute. George,
thank you. Thank you so much for a wonderful and your introduction. Yeah. So if I may, we also have another World Food Prize laureate David Beckman. David there. Yeah, the 2010 laureate. And next to him is Peter McPherson, who was on the World Food Prize Council of Advisors. Not having any background in ag, yes. And I don't know, who else is here from the World Food Prize that I don't see? But you know, I don't have, you know, I was born in the Bronx. I have no background in agriculture. And my dad took a job in the Midwest, and that's how I ended up in Iowa and there. But I was smart enough to round up all of the people who knew a lot about agriculture and have them on my council. So, Peter, thank you for all many years of keeping me from going too far astray. If some of you saw me come in, you see I've got a cane and I'm limped up here onto the stage. I believe I was the only casualty of the solar eclipse. Going out, looking up at the sun, taking the glasses off, I fell, I broke my hip, I had to have emergency hip replacement surgery, and I've been kind of limping around ever since. And it's really hard for me to travel. And I have turned down a number of trips. Even one trip where they were going to give me some money for winning a prize. So that really hurts, right, on there. But I just spent 2 weeks in China, where actually you just get off the plane and they put you in a wheelchair, and I actually never set foot on Chinese soil because I was in the wheelchair the whole time. Very, very kind to me. I had to be evacuated from there because I developed a hangnail on my foot, but we can talk about that later. And coming here, the only two trips I've done. And I came here because of two people, Ambassador George Moose and Heidi Kuhn, and because of their commitment, involvement, and how they allow me to be on a voluntary, unpaid basis, part of working with them. And this event seemed such a crucial topic, so important at this time, transition in our government, that to be here and talk about the issues of peace through agriculture. So, George and I, and I'm going to talk about this, met when we were junior officers in the State Department and were assigned to Vietnam. And I'll talk a little bit more, but we have also a connection with about landmines. Yep. You see, we have the Iowa connection. Admiral Franken is going to be on panel, another Iowa guy. You get the idea here, you know, this is, and talk about, of course, peace and agriculture, and some about the Foreign Service and Diplomatic Corps. But how Heidi and I met was interesting. It goes back to 2019, and it was my last symposium that I was organizing as president of the World Food Prize. And I said, what should the theme be? What would resonate with Dr. Norman Borlaug, our greatest agricultural scientist? And what would capture, what's the thread running through my career, my then 55, now almost 60 years? And I came up with two words, Pax Agricultura, peace through agriculture. See, it paid to take 4 years of Latin in high school, Catholic high school, you know, that's Pax Agricultura, because it is, however improbable it is, from some kid from Decatur Avenue in the Bronx to end up talking about that was kind of an amazing journey. So I'm putting together my Borlaug Dialogue Symposium. I want to have a session on looking ahead, on climate change. I reached into our government, so invited Ambassador Moose, John Negroponte, Ryan Crocker, Wendy Chamberlain, other ones.
Mark Green,
yes. Bill Burns, the last couple of years. They all would come to Des Moines, lure them out there. And we were having and I also wanted to have, though, a panel about post-conflict situation. So I brought in the Minister of Agriculture from Rwanda, who's dealing with genocide recovery. And then I had the Minister of Transportation from Cambodia, who I knew, dealing with another genocide. I had the head of Aegis Trust in Britain. It's all about preventing genocide. So, but I don't have anybody from Vietnam. And then Pat Sheikh, who was had been leading the Agricultural Service, Foreign Service at USDA, said, I'm working with an organization called Roots of Peace, and we have our founder and CEO, and we're doing things in Vietnam. So I said, oh, sounds good, you know, send the letter off to her. And I'd never heard of Roots of Peace, I didn't know anything. And Heidi Kuhn gets invited, shows up in Des Moines. We're having a welcoming lunch for the speakers. Mark Green is there. And Heidi comes up and introduces herself to me. And I said, hi, and she starts telling me about Roots of Peace. And she talks about demining, the first step. And I go, oh. I said, I know something about demining from going to Vietnam. And then I said, the line that worked, I said, it's sobering to realize that the last casualty of the Vietnam War has yet to take place. So 2025, 50th anniversary, it hurts me to say that,
yes.
50 years, of the end of the Vietnam War, and there will be for sure somebody in Quang Tri who's going to hit some unexploded ordnance, despite the efforts of Tucker Kuhn, who's here, and the wonderful program they still have, the demilitarized zone, to do this. And this was the line that bonded us. I think it's, you know, if you look back, these you know, movies say, you had me at demining, right? Yeah, me at demining. And we bonded over this, and over landmines and removal and part of development. So I was retiring. And Heidi says, why don't you come to Vietnam and see what we're doing? So, hey, you know, chance to go back, brush up on my rusty Vietnamese, take my wife, who's from Vietnam, back, and we go there. And then I find out that Heidi's kind of an unusual person in that, you know, somebody, what do you want to do for your birthday? Oh, you know, there's this nice restaurant I'd like to go. I'd like to go to a ball game. Heidi wants to detonate a landmine for, speaking of which, yeah, there, the landmine just went off here. That's push the button. I guess you can still hear me, right?
Yes,
it's still working.
Good. You're good.
Yeah. That was, you know, I told you that would work, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Get everybody's attention. And so on her birthday in January, there we are, the MAG, Mines Awareness Group, all female Vietnamese demining team, have, you know, found a mine, and Heidi's there ready to go. And she invites me to come up. And I get to put my thumb on with hers and push the button. And now there's one less, there's now 9,999,000 mines, you know, one's gone, one down. And this was, you know, amazing experience of what they're doing out there, because if you can't get rid of the mines and the UXO, the unexploded ordnance, then you can't farm, you can't introduce the new cash crops that can uplift people. So we're riding through Vietnam, and I get the chance to tell Heidi my story about how come I know anything about landmines. So now you have to go back to the mid-1960s when, passed the Foreign Service exam, the same time that Ambassador Moose did. And you'd go in and they'd say, well, where do you want to serve? So, you know, I'm from Dubuque. It used to be French territory a few hundred years. I figure I'll give it a shot. You know, I'd like to go to Paris or Vienna. And they said, well, you know, you're under 26, so you're still draft eligible. You're single, you're male, you haven't been in the military. There's a war going on. And before I knew what happened, I was assigned to something called MACV Cords, Military Assistance Command Vietnam, Civil Operations, Revolutionary Development Support, and 10 months of learning Vietnamese in Washington, D.C. in 1968, the most tumultuous year since the Civil War. You know? And the we get divided by sort of demonstrated proficiency. And I remember sitting in the language lab practicing next to George Moose. And his command of the tones is so perfect. And, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm struggling. And what's, is it a high rising tone or a falling tone? I always get them all wrong. And I barely made it through the 10 months. He's like, you know, a star pupil, you know, being at the front of the, just like in Catholic school, you know, I was used to it there. And we go off to Vietnam.
We go off to Vietnam.
Right. He heads up north to Quang Ngai, which is where the North Vietnamese units were, really dangerous. And they kept me down in the Mekong Delta in a place called Sadek, a province named Sadek. And there was a U.S. Navy installation there, Admiral, Brownwater Navy. And there was a young guy there, same time I was. You know, all the Navy, they're all tall, thin, strapping, good shape, good looking. Guys named John Kerry. And so John Kerry and I are in the same place in Vietnam at the same time in the war. So I wasn't in the embassy. I wasn't in the consulate general. I wasn't on a provincial team. I was on a district advisory team with 8 or 9 military guys. I slept next to 3 lieutenants, you know, our beds right, you know, like this. I had to pull guard duty at night with Fuzz and Slick, the team dogs. We loved Agent Orange. I'm affected by Agent Orange all my life. We loved Agent Orange because it cleared out all the weeds and you could see anybody coming up to blow you up on there. And my job was to promote development. And so in 1968, as a result of, at the time, Norman Borlaug is in Pakistan and India promoting his miracle wheat, the start of the Green Revolution. Rice developed by an American named Hank Beechel from Nebraska. I don't know how a guy from Nebraska develops rice, you know, there's not a lot of rice grown in Nebraska. But at the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines, and it's brought in to be encouraged farmers to use it because IR8 rice grows in half the time of traditional rice and with triple or quadruple the yield. So if you can get farmers to use it, life's going to be better. They'll see the government is good, the insurgents who are everywhere are bad, and will help win the hearts and minds of the people. Now, at that, so the ag advisors are coming down, going out, seeing farmers, try this. At the same time, there's this old dirt road that the French had built 50 years earlier that went through these 8 villages that were in my district, 8 villages. And this old broken down road, it was so many potholes and washed out. You only go like 5 miles an hour at all. And we were fixing it. And we had money from USAID and ESF and money. And by chance, we were fixing the road. And we built the road up through 4 of the 8 villages. So now, trucks could come down, it had gravel on it, firm base, culverts, no washing out. And the growing season comes. And as I drive through, I notice 2 things. Number one is it's only in the villages that have the new road that farmers use the new IR8 seeds. And second, where they use it, life is transformed almost overnight. Because now with all this surplus, you get 2 crops, surplus rice, trucks come down from Saigon, the farm gate, buying your surplus, and you have time to grow melons or other third crop. And prosperity went through the roof, except you were able to buy a new roof and put a metal roof on your house, and TVs, and people are buying motorbikes. And really unexpectedly, that in these villages where you never went at night and you only went during the day with a lot of security, in the villages with the road, now you could go during the day without any security and you could go at night. But you got to the end of the improved road and you moved on to the next village which doesn't have any improved road, and life was unchanged from what it had been, and the Viet Cong were still as active and in control. And I'm standing there 12,000 miles from Iowa, and I see for the first time what it was that transformed our country. What it was that transformed Iowa and Illinois and Nebraska and Indiana and Ohio was building all those farm-to-market roads and having the agricultural seeds brought out by from land-grant universities, from seed companies, out to farmers. And the roads meant kids stayed in school, which is why high school education became so widespread in America. But we had forgotten the lesson. You know, Abraham Lincoln signed the Morrill Act during the Civil War, establishing all of Purdue and Iowa State and making land-grant colleges all across the United States, Cal Davis, Mississippi State, and on every campus there's a school of architecture and engineering, and the other end is a school of agricultural, College of Agricultural Seeds and Fertilizer and Animal Agriculture. And they're there for a reason, because back in 1862, everybody understood they were an essential part of it. But we've forgotten it as a country. We've forgotten that lesson on that. So this was the lesson I took away. I think of myself as a foot soldier in the Green Revolution. And I took away to have with me and to the rest of my career in the Foreign Service. But I was coming to the end of my time, and my orders came, and I was going to be sent to Europe, as I had asked. They were going to send me to Harvard. You know, a guy from Dubuque had to go to Harvard? Are you kidding me? And then I had this sort of epiphany on the Mekong, where I was asked the question, why would you want to go and report on labor movements in Europe when here you're in the middle of this epic event of your generation and stepping through the cultural veil and making a difference? And so I wrote to the State Department, said, I don't want to go to Harvard. I don't want to be assigned to Europe. I want to stay in Vietnam. Now, probably many of you know that in business or organizations, NGOs, when there's such clear sign of mental instability, they bring you right home. But they were desperate for anybody to stay in Vietnam, and I stayed 5.5 years. I ended up writing a report about, the first ever report about Pol Pot Khmer Rouge and what they were going to do. And they were, you know, Stalin, Hitler, totalitarians, widespread deaths, and a 40-page report, sent it back, and absolutely no one in the U.S. government believed me. And so a year and a half later, Pol Pot takes over Cambodia, implements all the things I wrote about, and out of 7 million people in 4 years, 2 million are dead of that. Fast forward to 1990, Richard Solomon, who has a central
vision for this,
who I work with. Yeah. I'm sure his spirit is here.
He is definitely.
And I think, Dick, I know you're listening to me, and hope I got it right. And here, but I'm come back. I'm Deputy Assistant Secretary, and there's 25,000 Khmer Rouge. The Vietnamese army of 200,000 had been there for 10 years, couldn't get rid of them. They gave up, we negotiated. You guys leave, go home, we can reestablish diplomatic relations. And then I became ambassador. But I go to see Hun Sen, prime minister, and I said, let me tell you about a lesson I learned working in the Mekong Delta, which is that if you demine and you build and upgrade roads and you bring in seeds, it can be as transformative or even more so than boots on the ground and bombs and rockets. And we made a deal. I had like $13 million of USAID money. I said, we're going to go and in the roads And these roads, the Khmer Rouge were the expert deminers. They had mines everywhere. And go in, and I'm ambassador now, you know, not a kid FSO going off to Fort Bragg, as we had to, Fort Belvoir, walking down the booby trap trail, learning how to avoid landmines in the jungle, while all our classmates are off learning about which wine to serve at their diplomatic dinners there. And we had, and I'm back out with deminers. And you know, they're digging out with their trowels to go down and find the mine, hit it with the trowel, hopefully it doesn't go off, and then you bring in the explosives and blow it up one by one. And I'm kneeling next to this Cambodian, you know, American ambassador's there, we have to do a good job, keep at it. And one of the mines in front goes off, and it's like an anti-tank mine. It's like, whoa, you know.
Yeah.
Is this such a good idea?
That's, yeah, brings it home.
Uh-huh. But it worked. And as we upgraded these roads and brought in these seeds and opened up these areas, the Khmer Rouge fell apart. And Pol Pot is running. We're tracking him down, trying to capture him at Delta Force units, ready to take him out of Cambodia. And he commits suicide, or somebody kills him, whatever. And on March the 6th, 1999, I get a call from the Prime Minister's office. Said, the last Khmer Rouge commander has surrendered. We had eradicated the worst genocidal, mass-murdering, terrorist organization of the second half of the 20th century, using the formula of demining, upgrading roads, new seeds, peace through agriculture.
Ken, I wondered if, I know we could listen to your stories.
But we're over time.
But there's one more story I want you to talk about.
Oh.
Which comes as back to Iowa.
Yes.
Okay. And it is another dimension of the contributions that agriculture has made to the building of peace around the world over many, many years. And it has to do with folks who showed up in Iowa mainly to learn about how to do agriculture and do it well.
Mm.
But as a consequence of that, relationships were established that were enduring and helped, it contributed significantly to the building of peace. Can you talk about a couple of special visits?
Certainly.
Yeah, right.
So, after being in Vietnam, I went back a couple of years at the NSC and then came over and worked for Dick Holbrooke at State. And then I went to work for the governor of Iowa. And people said, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. You know, a
Governor
Pearson
Ray.
Fellow, Governor Robert Ray, one of the great
governors,
great Americans, great Republican governor, incredible guy. And we establish diplomatic relations with China. We fly off to China. I get to meet Deng Xiaoping. I get to talk with him about the Khmer Rouge. He trashed the Khmer Rouge to me, and that was amazing. Next year, a return visit by Chinese governors to America, and they stop in Iowa. And the leader of the delegation is the governor of Guangdong province in the south, where the center of agricultural development and the Shenzhen special zone and opening up free market ideas are floating around. And the leader of that, his name is Xi Jiangsun, happens to be the father of the current president of China. If only we had known at the time. But I get to escort him around Iowa, and you know, we take him to the Amana colonies, and we take him to John Deere and Iowa State and all the stops you can imagine and there. And out of this, I'm charged with negotiating a sister state relationship. And Governor Ray said, I want us to be sister states with Sichuan province, because they're a big manufacturing province. your job, State Department guy, is to get this. So I give it my best shot. I call Jan Barris and the National Committee, but, you know, strike three, I'm out. And we end up with a sister state relationship with Hebei province, just outside Beijing. Mm-hmm. Well, who knew that in 1985, I'm gone now, I was off running around Gaza and Lebanon, but in Hebei province, there's a corn processing delegation sent five or six individuals, including the party secretary of Zhengding County, a young 31-year-old guy named Xi Jinping. And Xi Jinping comes to Iowa. He meets with Governor Branstad in his office and goes to Muscatine, Iowa, where the incredible power of citizen diplomacy goes to work. And the people from Muscatine are so nice, and they don't want anything, and they treat him nice. And Xi Jinping's never forgotten this and that. And he still thinks of people from Iowa, this group of people. I kind of get included in that because I took his dad around. So when Xi Jinping's now vice president of China in 2012, and he comes back, and I'm the host of the U.S.-China High-Level Agricultural Symposium with Tom Vilsack and Terry Branstad both kind of collaborating on this. And I get to escort Xi Jinping into our building. And I say, oh, Mr. Vice President, he was vice president, about to become president. I said, Mr. Vice President, I'm so pleased to, you know, you have such an interesting story, how you came here as a young man. I'm going to commission a painting to hang in my building about you're coming here. And Xi Jinping said, thank you, you know, through the interpreter, thank you, it's nice. And I said, and by the way, I just shook your hand, and I'm one of the few Iowans shake your hand who also shook your father's hand when I took him around Iowa. And Xi Jinping was not usually given to being startled. He stops and his eyes get big, and he looks at me, and it's a big smile. And he says, you have two interesting stories. So on the painting, yeah, so in the China Daily, there's a story about the Iowa diplomat with two interesting stories. But the point is this, 2025, the 50th anniversary of the end of the war in Vietnam. It's the 40th anniversary of Xi Jinping coming to the United States and coming to Iowa. And as we look around, in a world beset with problems, Ukraine, Gaza, the terrible destruction, that having a way, building through agriculture to deal with that. Because remember I told you the 50th anniversary, and there's still the last casualty of the Vietnam War. So in 2075, yeah, when you'll still be interim president, I know. And you hold this gathering and that. Will people be saying that the last casualty of the fighting in Gaza has yet to take place? Mm-hmm. Will they be saying, is the last casualty of the Russian invasion and bombardment of Ukraine yet to take place? Because that's the legacy of war and why the demining is so critical, and why I got on the plane to come here and be with Heidi Kuhn, Roots of Peace, who is the poet laureate of inspiring people to be involved in this, and to be with my dear friend, colleague, and I think I have, you know, this special warfare certificate from Fort Bragg. You must have one too. But of this period of the American Foreign Service. So in 10 years, you know, if you go up here, there's a plaque in the diplomatic entrance. has about 370 or 80 names on it of people who have died in service abroad from the State Department other than natural causes. And there's about 35 or 40 of it, all from Vietnam, all colleagues of ours who were put, you know, never signed up, weren't drafted in the military, but whose, you know, lives were given, sacrifice. So I know a lot of talk about civil servants and government employees or so, but it's a very proud part of our service.
So please join me in thanking Ambassador Ken Quinn, not only for his powerful insights into that connection between agriculture and peace, but also for his many, many years of distinguished service and sacrifice. Thank you, Ken.
Yeah, thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this event. If you'd like to listen to more events or explore our other podcasts, visit usip.org/podcasts.